Okay, I'll go ahead and start. Today I'm going to talk about some statistical mechanics machinery. First I wanted to ask if there were any if anyone had a question from last time.
Quick question about the CNV and anisotropies. So you said that we can find from class, we can find that prediction from the temperature of the CNV for the neutrinos, right?
Yes.
Do we have to assume the amount of neutrinos that we have had in the early universe, or it's like?
So these software packages that predict the power spectrum of the CNV do include parameters that you can vary. If you want to change the amount of stress energy in the early universe that's in relativistic species. When I wrote that constraint on the board last time, I expressed it as something like this. I made the choice to convert the stress energy in relativistic species into a neutrino temperature. The way it's usually parameterized in code like CAMB and class is to assume that this number is fixed to 1.95 and parameterize and vary the number of neutrino species instead.
Oh, okay.
The two are equivalent, but I just chose to quote it this way in the lecture. That's a very sort of, let's call it a standard extension of the standard model that is varied all the time in cosmology papers to quote the constraint from this or that experiment on the cosmic neutrino background. Yes?
I have a question about the first homework, if that's okay.
Sure.
In one of the questions in the first problem, you're asking us to find how many times a photon basically goes around the universe during its lifetime.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yes. Doesn't that depend on the plane where the photon is emitted? Like, if I'm thinking, for example, in a stool, let's say, for example, because it's easier to visualize, a photon would have to travel less distance depending on the polar angle theta, the plane defined by theta.
For that problem to make sense, let me comment that the spatial curvature is assumed to be positive. And so we live on a sphere. The sphere has the property that if I start anywhere on the sphere, then I set off in any direction, distance that I have to travel to go around the universe once is always 2 pi r. Odd rod is the equator here. The length of the equator is 2 pi r, where r is the curvature radius. You would get 2 pi r if you started at any point on the sphere and went in any direction.
I see. So we are going in the direction that basically encircles the whole globe. I was picturing, for example, the photon could travel in a direction like this.
I guess one way of stating the assumption is that the photon moves on a geodesic.
Okay.
Any geodesic on the sphere is a circle that goes, a so-called great circle that goes around and has length 2 pi r.
Okay.
Of course, you can draw a smaller circle with a smaller circumference. But that wouldn't be a geodesic. That would represent the path of a photon that was, you know, bending. Would anyone else like to ask a question before we start talking about blackbody radiation and statistical mechanics? Okay, great. Thanks for the questions. The next bit of machinery that I'm going to build up are some formulas for doing computations with thermal gases or thermal plasmas. One way to think about it is that the content of this lecture and maybe half of the next one will just be like a big generalization of a formula that you learned in statistical mechanics. In a statistical mechanics class, you will have learned at some point that the energy density of a black body is some dimensionless constant times the temperature to the fourth power, where, actually, let me write it in two steps just to remind you where this comes from. I'll write it as an integral over wave numbers. Q over T minus 1. And if you do the integral, you get this. One way of thinking about this calculation is that it's the energy of a thermal gas of photons. I forgot to say that I'm always using units where HR equals C equals K Boltzmann equals 1. So if I have a cavity that contains a thermal gas of photons, then by assumption, I'm just assuming that the photon is the only particle I need to worry about. I'm not thinking about electrons or anything else. The probability that that entire gas is in the Boltzmann distribution, so that the probability of any state, any state of occupation numbers of the gas is e to the minus e over t proportional to, where e is the total energy of all of the photons in that state. That's one way of thinking about how this calculation works. Our goal at first will be to generalize this calculation from a gas of photons to a general multiparticle plasma. Where each particle can differ from the photon in a few ways. It can, each particle is allowed to have a non-zero rest mass, to have an arbitrary spin, it's conventional to use the letter G for the number of spin degrees of freedom, which is 2s plus 1, where s is the particle spin in units of h bar. And can be either a boson or a fermion, which, of course, is derived from the spin. But I'm including it separately because it changes some signs around, and I want to sort of single that difference out. I encourage you to just keep in mind as a running example, we'll mainly be applying these formulas to plasma consisting of positrons, electrons, and photons. I'll use this as a running example throughout the lecture. This plasma represents the state of the universe roughly at temperatures higher than 0.3 MeV, which is where the electrons and positrons annihilate, but lower than 100 MeV, which is where the pions and muons annihilate. Before I get into the calculation, I just want to, I thought it'd be helpful to just sort of quickly review some integrals and sums that I'll use freely throughout the calculations. So the first thing that I want to talk about is the gamma function. I think it's nice to separate out this content because, of course, it's like really generally useful for other calculations. We've all probably seen this integral before, the integral of e to the minus x times power of x. And if n is an integer, then this turns out to be n factorial, as you can prove by induction using integration by parts. If n is not an integer, then this integral is just, first off, just as a bit of notation, is defined to be the gamma function. We usually write gamma of n plus 1 instead of n factorial. This plus 1, I think, is an unfortunate historical convention. So if you need to work with this quantity, here's some identities that are useful. So this just generalizes the rule that says that n factorial is, sorry, this should be n times gamma of n. Sometimes I forget the plus 1. So this rule just generalizes the property of the factorial, that n factorial is equal to n times n minus 1 factorial. That's also that same identity is true even if the argument to the gamma function is not an integer. I'm still calling the argument n, but it's not necessarily an integer. And then another special value that's useful to know is that gamma of 1/2, or if you want, minus 1/2 factorial, is equal to the square root of pi. This is the famous Gaussian integral with small change of variables. So that means, for example, that if you want to compute the gamma function for any half integer, let's say gamma of 5/2, then it's computed this way. First, I'll use the first identity to make the argument to the gamma function gamma of 3/2. As you can see, when I try to write this on the blackboard, I'm constantly getting confused by the plus 1. And then I'll apply it one more time to bring the argument down to 1/2. And then I'll write this as 3/4 times the square root of pi. We'll only need the gamma function evaluated at integer and half integer arguments. The next little math mini topic I want to talk about is sums that are closely related to a geometric series. This formula for the geometric series needs no explanation. If you encounter something closely related like this, the sum of n times x to the n. More generally, this trick will work for with any polynomial in n sitting in front of the x to the n. Then if you play around a bit, you can write it in terms of derivatives of the geometric series. So this is, you might notice that this is if I took the left-hand side of the geometric series and took its derivative, then I almost have what I want. I then have n times x to the n minus 1. And so I'll just put in one more power of x. And that reduces the sum then to the geometric series. And taking that derivative, I get x over 1 minus x squared. I think I'll encounter a couple of sums like this, and I'll just, when they arise, I'll just write the answer down and comment that you can do this sort of trick. Okay. The next little mini topic, doing like a couple of minutes per mini topic, we'll see a bunch of sums like this. So this infinite series frequently arises and turns out to be equal to pi squared over 6. It's very non-trivial to derive that, but I'll just quote it. Then like a related identity that we've all seen at one point or another with the fourth power is you also get. That also turns out to be doable in closed form, and you get pi to the fourth over 90. So I'd like to mention that the generalization of this type of sum to an arbitrary exponent has a name, the Riemann zeta function. And so, for example, this first sum could be written as zeta 2 or zeta 4, but these values happen to be expressible in closed form. I'm not really going to say much about the Riemann zeta function except that just to use it as a notation for packaging up a sum like this. So we'll see, for example, zeta 3 sometimes appearing in calculations, and that has some value that's in my notes. 3.02. I think zeta of 3 is also called Apérie's constant. Zeta 5. Turns out that the zeta function can be evaluated analytically at even integer values of n, but not otherwise, as far as I know. There's no sort of closed form for zeta 3 or zeta 5. I'm going to use the Riemann zeta function, but only in sort of a superficial way, where I just where quantities like this will appear in calculations, and then you may need to evaluate them numerically if you were wanted to get a number at the end. Oh yeah. So another type of sum that doesn't have a name, let's call it the alternating zeta function, is one where, shown here for s equals 4, where you alternate the signs. So this type of series can be done by the following trick. So if I... let's call it 2 times m over 2 to the 4. In this step, I've noticed that if I take the usual zeta function sum with all pluses and multiply by 1 minus... 1/8, but I wrote it as minus 2 over 2 to the 4. Then I get the sum with alternating signs. You can see that for, odd, when I put in this term, I reproduce all the even terms in the sum with a minus 2 in front. And so when I add those back in, I flip the signs of the even powers. Or more generally, for any s, if I have the zeta type sum with alternating signs, then it's 1 minus 1 over 2 to the s minus 1 times zeta of s. I guess I sort of forgot to finish the calculation here and write it as 7/8 times pi to the 4th over 90. Okay. Then the last math identity that I want to write down is this. I made an error on this board that's bugging me so much that I'm going to lower the board. This should have been Q, not Q cubed. The Q, you only get the Q cubed when you replace the D3Q by Q squared DQ. Okay. So here's a type of integral that comes up. Let me give this a name just so I can refer to it later and call it the thermal bosonic integral. So this comes up, for example, in the classical blackbody calculation. So it can be done. If I were just staring at the integral, I would never think of this, but because it comes up in so many calculations, there's this interesting trick of first writing 1 over e to the x minus 1 like this. Using the geometric series formula kind of in reverse. Okay, and then I'll write that as so I'm now starting at n equals 1, e to the minus nx. And then actually maybe it's clearer if I write that out like this. The minus x plus minus 2x. And then I'll integrate each of these terms separately. The first term you'll recognize is the definition of the gamma function at argument k plus 1. And then for the next term with e to the minus 2x, I can change variables to make it look like the gamma function. That brings down a factor of 1 over 2 to the k plus 1. When I change variables to get rid of the 2 here, I get 1 over 2 to the k here, and then a 1 half in the dx. And then so on down the line. You recognize this as the product of the zeta function and the gamma function, both evaluated at k plus 1. So for example, if k is 3, as happens in the usual blackbody calculation, then you get pi to the 4th over 90, that's zeta of 4, times 6. Which is where the pi squared over 15 comes from. Then, so you've seen this integral before at some point when deriving the blackbody formula. It turns out that when you have fermions around, you get a slightly different integral. Fermionic thermal integral. I'll explain why in a bit, but all that happens, well, when you have fermions around you, you end up getting a similar integral, but with a plus sign in the denominator, the sign just ends up being flipped. And so the same method of integration works, just with some flipped signs. Let me make this step change. 1 plus e to the minus x. Then now in this step, I'll get some alternating signs. And now when I integrate term by term, I'm just getting the same terms as before, but with some sign flips. Let me put in a step here where I just pull out the gamma function to see what I ended up with. And then a few blackboards ago, we showed how to do this zeta type sum with alternating signs, just or at least do it in the sense that it's reduced to. The sum with all pluses, which has a name, the Riemann zeta function. And we know how to evaluate it for a few special values of k. And so I'll write the answer this way. So in summary, this integral with the sign flip in the denominator ends up being the same, except for this prefactor of 1 minus 1 over 2 to the k. So that was sort of a rapid-fire sequence of like calculational tricks and identities. I kind of like just presenting them up front, just so that when we do calculations, we can refer back to them instead of getting derailed by them and having to do them as a tangent. Okay, so now I want to think about a multiparticle plasma. And I want to compute the energy density of the plasma. I'll compute that by summing or integrating over modes, where one mode, I'm defining a mode of the plasma to be a choice of species. In other words, the total energy will be a sum over the energy densities in electrons, positrons, and photons. Spin state, meaning that for an electron, there are two spin states to sum over, and same for the same for the other two particles. And momentum, q. So restricting attention to a single mode, then the occupation number of the mode, which I'll denote by n sub q, the number of particles with the given spin and momentum, is a random variable which is proportional to the energy of the state, which is e to the minus, maybe I'll just suppress the q. We won't need this notation very long, and I don't like having subscripts and superscripts. So the probability of having occupation number n is the energy of an e to the minus the energy of the n particle state divided by t, where eq is the energy of the particle. That would just be q for a photon in the classical blackbody calculation. But here I'm allowing the particle to have a mass, so I'll define eq to be the total energy of the particle, including its rest mass. You can already sort of see that if the temperature is small compared to the rest mass of the particle, then all of the states with n greater than 0 are going to be very exponentially suppressed, which is consistent with our earlier statement that when the temperature of the plasma falls below the rest mass of a particle like the electron, that particle starts to annihilate and go away. It's no longer thermally, its presence or not at non-zero occupation numbers are no longer thermodynamically favored. Whether the particle is a boson or a fermion matters in the sense that it determines which n are allowed. So for a fermion, n has to be 0 or 1 by the exclusion principle. But for a boson, any value of n is allowed. Okay. So I'd like to calculate, I'll use the notation F sub Q a lot. And this will generally mean the mean occupation number. Based on these physical statements, I can calculate FQ, and I'll do that calculation separately for the boson or the fermion. I'll start with the fermion. So, actually, before I do that, let me write this line. FQ is just going to be the sum over n of n times p of n. This is just how I would calculate that mean, where the sum of the pn's has to equal 1 because it's a probability distribution. So for a fermion, there are two possibilities. So for a fermion, I snuck in the proportional to notation over here. There's always a Boltzmann or thermal distribution always means that the probability is proportional to e to the minus energy over t, with some denominator that's determined by the requirement that all the probabilities add up to 1. So for the fermion, the probability of having occupation number n is e to the minus e n e q over t divided by the sum, where the sum here just goes from n equals 0 to 1. So this gives sum over n. So I can write this as e to the minus neq over t, where 1 plus e to the minus eq over t. So in this step, I just took the Boltzmann distribution, which was expressed with the overall normalization unspecified before, and filled in that denominator, where n is in 0. And then I said that my plan was to calculate fq, so that'll be the sum of n times p of n, where n goes from 0 to 1. And so that's the n equals 0 term is 0, and the n equals 1 term looks like this. And then I'll simplify that a little bit and write it this way. Plus that. This is the mean occupation number, or number of particles, in a mode with momentum q and temperature t, if the particle is a fermion. The boson calculation is really similar. So now the probability of the n particle state is given by this Boltzmann factor, e to the minus energy over t, divided by a normalization constant requiring that the sum of all the probabilities equals 1. It's the same as before. It's just now I just run the sum from n equals 0 to infinity. And so that's e to the minus, that's a geometric series. Over minus e to the minus q over t to the minus 1. I'll just leave the answer in that form. And then the mean occupation number given by summing n times p of n, where now the sum goes from 0 to infinity. So that's a pull-out. Pull out this factor. And I'll write it this way. And so this is one of those sums that I talked about a few minutes ago that's closely related to the geometric series. It's a sum of the form n times x to the n, where x is e to the minus e qt, e to the minus energy over t. So according to our formula, that's, let's say I had a power of x in the numerator, so I'll write e to the minus energy over t. And I had two powers here in the denominator. I'll continue the calculation up here. Gives e to the minus energy over t over minus e to the t, which I can write this way. After a bit of calculation, the mean occupation number, or expected number of particles for a boson, is the same as the fermion, except for the flipped sign. There's a notational convention. We'll be doing a lot of calculations like this, that where there are separate cases for bosons and fermions. And so there's a notational convention that where I'll often write formulas this way, so they apply to both cases. Where the formula applies to both bosons and fermions if the upper sign is used for a boson and the lower sign is used for a fermion. We actually made a lot of progress toward calculating the energy density of our plasma. We now just need to We've computed the energy of a single mode. And now to get the energy of the plasma, we just need to sum over all the modes. Let me start by writing, since the goal is to calculate rho, let me start by calculating rho this way. I'll be dividing by some volume. I always imagine that I'm considering the plasma in some sort of box or finite volume. And then I want to sum over species, spins, and momenta q. And what I'm summing is, So FQ is the expected number of particles in a mode Q. And to get the expected energy, I would multiply by the energy of each particle. The next step is seeing what to do with the sum over Q. So here's a really general rule that applies to both this calculation or more generally in other calculations that where you're summing over momenta, usually with some factor of 1 over volume. So the rule is that if the volume is large, then to sum over momenta, it's an accurate approximation to replace the sum by an integral with this factor of 2 pi cubed. I think that's the part that sort of needs some explanation, and also a factor of the volume. So to explain how it's unsurprising that if you are summing over momenta that that's approximated by an integral, but this factor of v over 2 pi cubed, the normalization, is what I want to explain. Here's one way of thinking about this normalization. So the details of the argument depend a bit on what boundary conditions you assume. But generally speaking, the issue of boundary conditions is kind of a distraction because it will only correct the mode counting by factors of area. And so if I'm taking the large volume limit, and any boundary condition should give the same answer. And so there's one set of boundary conditions where the counting is very simple, and that's periodic boundary conditions. So imagine instead of having a box, a real box, I've wrapped the sides of the box around. So that I have some periodic volume with side lengths Lx, Ly, and Lz. When I impose those periodic boundary conditions, wave numbers become quantized. So a wave number, the only allowed values for the wave numbers are an integer multiple of 2 pi over Lx, an integer multiple of 2 pi over Ly, and an integer multiple of 2 pi over Lz. And the reason for that is because of the, or one way of thinking about it, is the single-valuedness of the wave function in quantum mechanics. If I have a particle whose wave function looks like e to the I q dot x, that's what it means to have momentum q. Then if that wave function is to be single-valued in a periodic setting, then it should have the property that if I change the x-coordinate by Lx, that I get the same value of psi. And that happens if, let me write this as e to the I QXLX plus I. QXLX. And so that happens. If I change, x, y, z. If I change x by lx, then I'll get the same phase if and only if qx is an integer multiple of 2 pi over lx. And likewise for the other coordinates. You can see that a factor like 2 pi cubed over the volume lx ly is kind of starting to emerge here if I multiply these together. And so that means if I imagine drawing like a diagram of where the allowed q's are in the like in the qx, qy plane, that they live on a lattice whose spacings are 2 pi over the box length lx, 2 pi over the box length ly, and likewise for the z coordinate. If I'm summing over these q's, and I want to approximate that sum by an integral, then in addition to the d3q, I want to divide by the volume of the lattice. Or the volume of this cell in Q space, which I've shown, can read off from this picture that that's the product of these side lengths in Q space, which then gives the V over D3Q over 2 pi cubed. I think this rule for summing over momenta in a volume is useful in all sorts of physics contexts. So I thought it was worth going on this little tangent to derive it really with all the steps filled in. Okay, wow. Shocked to see that 50 minutes have gone by. Like, time flies when you're doing these fun calculations. Okay. So then, to compute the energy density of the plasma, I can replace this sum by an integral. I'll leave the middle sum as just a sum over spins. And then I'll write FQ as EQ over to the minus EQ over T minus plus 1. Where, just to remind you of the definition of, I think I like it even better if I leave it as FQEQ in the step. Then in the next step, I'll do two things. The sum over spins here, each spin makes the same contribution. So I'll just replace that sum over spins by a factor of G, where G is 1 for a scalar, 2 for spin 1 half, and so on. EQ over, and then in this step I'll plug in the thermal form for the mean occupation number FQ. I'll remind you that EQ is just defined to be Q squared, the square root of Q squared plus M squared, where M is the particle mass. Okay. You know, I'm going to write one more line here and replace, I'll replace D3Q by 4 pi Q squared DQ. Which you can always do if the integrand is independent of the direction of Q, to write it this way. Q 2 over 2 pi squared. Okay. So this is our main result that applies to, gives the energy density for a thermal plasma, such as an E plus C minus photon plasma. As a check on this calculation, you can verify that it gives the usual blackbody result in the case where the only species is a photon. For a photon, the G factor here is 2. And then the EQ becomes equal to Q. Then the integral can be done analytically. The photon is a boson, so the sign here is minus. Using that, what I called the bosonic thermal integral when I wrote it down before. For general M, this integral can't be done analytically. In fact, you know, in some contexts, you would want to just integrate it numerically. It simplifies in either the relativistic or non-relativistic limits. So in the next lecture, I'll start by taking this exact formula, which is true at any temperature, working out the limiting behavior at low and high temperature. Finally, let me just point out that I forgot to get rid of some factors of 1 over V. That 1 over V should have gone away in this step, where I replaced the sum by the integral. There was a factor of V here. So I'll get rid of it here and here as well. Okay. So we're kind of in the middle of this calculation because the next step is gonna be the high temperature and low temperature limits. This is a natural place to pause. So I'll stop here and pick up again next time. Let me ask if there are any questions on I did just a lot of calculations in a row. Let me just pause and ask if there are any questions on any of these calculations. Yes, yes.
So the period of the your volume is 2 pi, or like I wonder why there's a factor of 2 pi appearing.
Yeah. I think it's like it's not so easy to see. So I wanted to kind of derive that. One way of getting the factor of 2 pi, one argument that I like because it applies both to a massive and a massless particle, is to say that in quantum mechanics, every particle should have a wave function. And it will turn out that in a periodic setting where we're demanding that the wave function is periodic under these spacings, that quantizes the momentum q. And the way that you see that is what momentum q means is that the wave function is proportional to e to the iq dot x. If I want the wave function to have the same periodicity as the box, it should have the property that if I translate the wave function, translate the value of x by lx, say, the wave function doesn't change. And that happens if and only if qx is an integer multiple of 2 pi over lx. If If it is, then when I shift the value of x by lx, then e to the iqx times x will shift by e to the 2 pi I times this integer. And I'll get the same value of psi.
Why this boundary condition works for all of the boundary conditions?
Yeah, right. So, you know, at least in, like when I took statistical mechanics a long time ago, I remember seeing a more complicated argument that assumed some more specific set of boundary conditions. But you end up with the same counting. Generally speaking, the boundary conditions, just because they're associated with the boundary, only sort of correct the mode counting by factors that are subleading in the size of the box. Like the number of modes in some region in the Q plane should be roughly proportional to the box volume, with some boundary condition dependent corrections that go like the area. The choice of boundary conditions really shouldn't affect the final answer, at least in the large volume limit. I chose the boundary conditions that just made the counting the cleanest. The periodic boundary conditions are really nice since it's a lot easier to see how the wave numbers get quantized. Yes.
So again, it's related to the homework, but something that confused me. Maybe we'll discuss it in later lectures. In which case, just tell me that we'll see it in the next lecture. So in the second problem, we're using a distribution for the CNB, where we're using e to the minus q over t, which is the ultra-relativistic limit.
But oh, yes.
To use the non-relativistic limit for u, if I remember correctly. Isn't this a little contradictory?
Yeah. So the CNB, one thing that I think I say in that problem somewhere, is that so for a thermal species, one which is like, you know, part of a thermal plasma, the mode function takes this form. The CNB at late times, meaning any time when the universe is colder than an MeV, turns out to have a different mode function. Now, this is something that I can't really derive yet, since we haven't really talked about the physics of the CNB. I'll go ahead and put in the plus sign, just because the neutrino is a fermion. So the CNB is not in thermal equilibrium. And so its mode function is different. It turns out that all that happens is the energy here just becomes a factor of Q. Those are non-equivalent if the neutrino mass is non-zero. That leads to different non-relativistic limits. If the CNB was neutrinos were still thermal, then what would happen is that as soon as the temperature of the plasma fell below the rest mass of the neutrino, they would start to annihilate. Their abundance would be exponentially suppressed in the non-relativistic limit. In that problem, you'll show that with this non-thermal occupation function, what actually happens is that the abundance is proportional to the mass and it's not exponentially suppressed.
Will we see in later lectures why that happens?
Oh, yeah. This is something that's like really non-obvious, but we need to develop a little bit of machinery to see it.
Okay.
Okay. If there are no more questions, let's break for today. And I'll see you at 1 o'clock tomorrow.